you so much. It's great to be back. Such warm hosts, and I'll say warm weather as well. Seems certainly warmer than where I'm from. And it's nice to see the growth of this meeting since I was here the last time. I think it was even more than 5 or 6 years ago. It was a while ago. I'm going to try to be a little provocative today, and I'll be eager afterwards for discussion and what you all think of the messaging. And throughout the talk, I think what you'll see is that I'm going to be referencing a lot of recently published papers that represent long-term follow-up of pivotal clinical trials. And I think that really emphasizes the importance of clinical trials and the importance of long-term follow-up in this disease. I have no potential conflicts of interest, and I was here bright and early this morning, and I know those of you who were here for the histology section will recognize this slide, the classic presentation of follicular lymphoma with the nodular components in the biopsy. So in this era that we're living in now, unlike large cell lymphoma that we just heard about in detail, for most patients with follicular lymphoma, outcomes are very favorable with current treatments. And when I meet a patient with follicular lymphoma in the clinic, I can say to them very confidently that most patients with follicular lymphoma will not die of follicular lymphoma. That said, similar to the large cell story that we just heard, it is a heterogeneous disease. And although we can identify some favorable clinical presentations, we are way behind in this disease than we are in large cell lymphoma. We don't have good genetic signatures. Our understanding of the tumor microenvironment and host interactions is still somewhat nascent. And the heterogeneity of follicular lymphoma really currently limits precision medicine approaches. And in fact, when you do a biopsy of a patient with follicular lymphoma, even within the lymph node, there may be multiple clones that are represented. And of course, patients with follicular lymphoma have many lymph nodes frequently. And if you biopsy multiple lymph nodes, you may have different clones that have expanded. So even getting a genetic or molecular signature in this disease could be difficult. And to set up the talk, I'll say that at least the teaching still has been that this is viewed by many as an incurable disease with standard therapies. So we'll see if we can revisit that and really ask the question, is this still true? So the heterogeneity of follicular lymphoma can be defined many ways. This just demonstrates that using simple clinical factors, we can group patients into groups of patients who do well and groups of patients who do less well. These data are old data. The overall survival is almost certainly improved even for the high-risk group today. But it suggests that not all follicular lymphoma is the same. I'm not going to cover the several prognostic indices that have been recently published. These have leveraged clinical trials and have looked at various genes and often grouped gene expression with sometimes mutation analysis. All I can say is that all of these confirm biologic heterogeneity. And honestly, to some degree, it's maybe a little bit similar to the marginal zone situation that we heard about, because although there may be a reproducible translocation in follicular lymphoma, there isn't one mutation that defines this disease. There are many, many mutations that can be present. So, and the problem with these prognostic indices is that none of them serve as predictive biomarkers for a precision approach to therapy. So they can be used to say a patient may do worse or better, but we don't have data that suggests that they can tell us how to treat a particular patient. It may be that as we get better at analyzing circulating tumor DNA, that will improve. Because in theory, at least, circulating tumor DNA might integrate these various clones that are existent in a patient, so you don't have to biopsy all of the lymph nodes to understand the true nature of their disease. All right, so for a favorable disease for most patients, though, I think it's important to say, what are the goals of treatment? And ideally, you'd like to change the natural history of the disease. Simply defined, you'd like patients to live longer. And a good surrogate for that in this disease may be to also decrease transformation of the disease, because transformation still represents a high-risk situation. More commonly, we analyze data looking at remission rates with a presumption that if a patient's in remission, they're going to feel better. That may or may not be true in this disease. I think we've all met patients who have a fairly high disease burden and feel just fine. And if they didn't see a lymph node, or if their lymph nodes are deep in their abdomen, they may not even know it. And of course, quality of life is important. So any intervention here has to be shared decision making with the patient as far as what they want. And I am going to try to review some quality of life data as I go through these studies, recognizing that the science around quality of life is not perfect. It's not necessarily as clear as looking at a CAT scan as far as whether the measures of quality of life truly reflect the patient experience. So I'll start with some comments on low tumor burden follicular lymphoma. And many of you are familiar with this trial, hard to believe, published initially more than a decade ago. This was a randomized trial of early intervention, historic early intervention trials comparing chemotherapy to watch and wait, showed no benefit to the chemotherapy, and essentially you were just giving patients side effects. But the thought was rituximab is much better tolerated, potentially more active, and maybe better if used up front. So this was a study that was done in the UK, randomized patients to either rituximab in a prolonged maintenance schedule, or to watch and wait. And when this was published, you could see that there was a significant progression-free survival benefit to patients who received prolonged rituximab. Should surprise nobody that treatment that works is going to extend a remission duration compared to nothing. So it was not really able to be interpreted. However, just this year, we've seen now 15-year follow-up of this trial. And I think now we can glean some important lessons from this trial. And honestly, these results surprise me to some degree. You can see that if you look at progression-free survival of the watch and wait group, the median time to progression was 2.5 years. That's a bit longer than historic, suggesting that these patients may have had very indolent disease going into the trial. But it's in keeping with many of the patients who we follow, who we observe. Just getting 4 doses of rituximab moved that median to 11 years. And if you extend the rituximab out, it moved that median to 15 years, meaning that you give, if the 11-year statistic suggests that you give 4 doses of rituximab, and 11 years later, more than half the patients are alive and have not progressed. That's fairly remarkable efficacy for a very low toxicity intervention. You can see on the slide here that there were no differences in overall survival and no differences in transformation. They looked at quality of life as well, and of course they look at a lot of different domains, and they look at them at different time points, but you could argue both sides. Many of the studies of early intervention have suggested that at the beginning, the quality of life may be worse because you're dealing with toxicities of treatment. On the other hand, if you're not getting treated, you're dealing with anxiety about when you're going to need treatment. The way this seemed to play out, at least using these tools, were that there were improved quality of life scores in certain domains in the patients who got treated. And I think, put another way, there was no clear detriment to quality of life with this early treatment intervention. So how do we conclude this? You know, if you're a believer in doing as little as possible, you could certainly say, well, there's no survival benefit, no change in transformation. I'm going to keep observing patients. And in fact, about a third of the patients in the watchful waiting group didn't need any treatment in 15 years, suggesting that if you treat patients, a third of them may be overtreated. That said, there were very low rates of high-grade toxicities associated with rituximab. The overall rate of transformation was low. And clearly, in this group of patients, I think the conclusion that they had in the manuscript is not unreasonable to say that early rituximab monotherapy substantially delays the need for new treatment, that confirms the value for patients who seek to avoid or defer treatment with chemotherapy. And you could certainly envision multiple patients in this category, maybe an older patient with comorbidities. You could kind of treat them once and maybe never need to give treatment again. I think in the back of your mind, you should be thinking, just based on the theme of the talk, if you have a treatment, you give four doses of rituximab, and 11 years later, half the patients haven't experienced progression, when are we comfortable saying that those patients are cured? I think there are a few things in medicine where you give a treatment over a very short period of time. More than 10 years goes by and nothing happens, and yet you're still saying that it's an incurable disease. We'll come back to that. So another important study for which we now have long-term follow-up was the RESORT trial. Somewhat different design. Here, everybody got rituximab up front, and then they asked a question about whether you should give rituximab continuously or on an as-needed basis. And the original publication showed there was really no difference in the time that rituximab worked, so the as-needed rituximab was considered the preferred strategy. Published last year was a 12-year follow-up of this trial, and this is the curve of the patients who got as-needed rituximab, and you can see that at 10 years, 30% of patients in this study remain disease-free. You could argue there may be some flattening of this curve in time. If you look at the overall survival and transformation, similar to what we saw in the UK trial, there was no difference. And quality of life here was analyzed not up to 12 years, but for the first few years on the trial. And you can see that there was a slight improvement in anxiety when treatment was started, but otherwise there were really no major differences. And in fact, over time, I think as patients adjusted to their disease, the quality of life improved with both strategies. Finally, this trial was just published a few years ago. This was a randomized trial looking at short versus prolonged rituximab monotherapy. And there wasn't really a difference in that strategy. But again, what you can see with event-free survival is that there's a substantial proportion of patients who can go very long after a short course of rituximab without requiring any additional treatment, really suggesting to some degree the benefit of this approach. So putting all this together, I think it's very clear in low tumor burden disease that overall survival in recent data sets is better compared with historical trials. As much as there may be some enthusiasm to treat early, we have to acknowledge there's still no survival benefit or decreased transformation risk associated with early intervention, but that many patients who receive limited rituximab dosing, maybe only four doses, have very prolonged remissions and improved quality of life. So to put this together, I think the optimal management strategy is complex. It should be individualized. As I said before, we should really recognize that remission may not be an optimal surrogate for clinical benefit in this very indolent disease. There are costs associated with both strategies. There's financial cost and clinic cost of coming in and getting treated, but there's anxiety maybe if you don't get treated. And people are constantly reminded if they feel these lymph nodes and if you can make them disappear, sometimes that's a good thing. Treatment-free intervals may be important to patients. And again, I would say that we may be curing some of these patients. So our group in SWOG in the US is trying to leverage these promising results and move forward with a bit more aggressive approach, looking at the role of a bispecific antibody in low tumor burden disease, asking the question, can we cure more of these patients, or can we have very long responses in more of these patients? I'll just remind you that the bispecific antibody that we're using, mosunetuzumab, is directed against CD3 and CD20. In heavily relapsed disease that's refractory to rituximab and including patients who have had CAR-T treatment, response rate is quite high, and for patients who achieve complete response, it seems durable. And of course, these results are only between 3 and 5 years of follow-up right now, but the durability, there really seem to be very few events after 2 years that have been reported, and that's holding. So clearly the theory would be that using this drug in the setting of a healthy immune system may have it be more efficacious. In the setting of low tumor burden disease, it will be less toxic with less cytokine release syndrome, and perhaps with a limited duration therapy, you may be able to cure more patients. So the strategy is to compare 8 doses of rituximab on the so-called SAC schedule from our colleagues in Switzerland to 8 doses of mosunetuzumab, or 8 cycles of mosunetuzumab, which is all going to be given subcutaneously, which is tolerated better, at least in some of the clinical trials, compared to the currently approved IV formulation. And we've purposely designed this trial to follow patients for a long time to again try to definitively address the question, will this be curative in some patients? And if the floor is the 11-year result with rituximab, it's possible mosunetuzumab will be much better than that, and I think that will be an exciting result to see. All right, so now what about high tumor burden follicular lymphoma? And here, you know, observation isn't a question, but I think the question of cure is still a provocative issue. So the study that I thought I would start with is the Gallium study. And I want to make a couple of points regarding this trial. This was a randomized trial comparing chemoimmunotherapy approaches using 2 different antibodies, either rituximab or obinutuzumab. The chemotherapy was at the investigator discretion, and that's an important point because some patients here got bendamustine, some patients got CHOP, some patients got CVP. What you can see is when the results were initially published, there was a small, statistically significant difference in progression-free survival favoring obinutuzumab. The clinical significance of that, I think, was questioned. And many people, myself included, have not universally adopted obinutuzumab in this situation. But I found somewhat provocative the fact that at 2 years, the progression-free survival of the patients that were randomized to rituximab was 81%, and those who were randomized to obinutuzumab was 88%. And the reason why that's provocative is that in follicular lymphoma, the concept of early disease progression, which we described, seems to occur about 20% of the time, no matter what chemotherapy regimen you give and whether you give maintenance or not. And patients who have early disease progression have markedly worse outcomes. So I thought it was interesting at early follow-up in this study to say, well, if you're really changing the rate of early disease progression, might you be impacting that high-risk group in some way such that you would see in the long term a more durable benefit? Quality of life in this study really didn't differ very much between the two, but again shows these trends where in the high tumor burden situation, as you take lymphoma-related symptoms away, patients start feeling better. This trial built in a maintenance component to both arms. Both arms got prolonged antibody treatment, either with rituximab or obinutuzumab. And one of the things that we observed in the follow-up of this study is that particularly patients who got bendamustine had a significant drop in their CD4 counts, which in the context of prolonged depletion of B cells resulted in a significant increase in infection rate and some infection-related deaths. If you look at the long-term follow-up, on the positive side, the difference between obinutuzumab and rituximab seemed to be maintained, but the overall survival was absolutely no different. And put another way, the fact that you changed the rate of early disease progression, at least to date, has not resulted in any overall survival benefit. And because the early progressors have a median overall survival of, 5 years or so, you would have expected to potentially see an overall survival benefit already if that group were responsible for the difference. All right, the other study that we have some long-term follow-up on is the RELEVANCE trial. This was a trial that compared chemoimmunotherapy to the combination of rituximab and lenalidomide. I think it's important when we analyze the study to understand that the chemotherapy, of course, was given for 6 months, and then there was a maintenance form of rituximab that lasted for about 2 years. The lenalidomide arm, patients got both lenalidomide and rituximab for about a year, and then additional rituximab for about a year, and some patients actually got lenalidomide for up to 18 months. So long-term outcomes were published a couple of years ago in this trial, and interestingly, there were no differences in progression-free survival between these two approaches. And I just listed some of the patient characteristics here to reassure you that this was a reasonably high-risk group of patients with follicular lymphoma. About half of them had high-risk FLIPI, and 40% had bulky disease. That said, similar to the obinutuzumab, I think very few centers, certainly in the United States, have switched to using lenalidomide rather than chemoimmunotherapy in this situation up front, and the question is why. So first of all, there was no difference in overall survival. Second of all, again, chemotherapy was different could be given at the investigator discretion. And you can see that there seemed to be a favoring toward the chemotherapy arm of patients who got the bendamustine compared to those who got CVP. And put another way, the CVP kind of maybe dragged down the outcome of the chemoimmunotherapy arm. So, this wasn't designed to compare lenalidomide head-to-head with each of these chemotherapy regimens, but the trend is such that the chemotherapy that we more commonly use now may be somewhat better than the lenalidomide. But this is the real reason why I think that we haven't changed, and that is it's different therapy, but it's not necessarily less toxic. You'd like to think, it's just a pill, it's going to be easier than the chemoimmunotherapy. But if you looked at withdrawals from treatment on this trial, 43 patients in lenalidomide arm and only 16 patients in the chemotherapy arm withdrew because of toxicity. And part of that's because the lenalidomide went a lot longer, but that's the point, is that you're not really comparing apples to apples in this situation. And I think that we've all recognized that it can be hard to give lenalidomide for a very long period of time to a older patient with follicular lymphoma. So this was another trial that was just published this year that looked at the lenalidomide rituximab regimen. This trial compared it to rituximab alone. Not surprisingly, you saw a significant benefit with the lenalidomide, no difference in overall survival. But over 60% of the patients who got rituximab and lenalidomide remained in first CR at 10 years of follow-up. So I think taken together, we're seeing these signals with all of these recent publications, long-term follow-up, that a subset of patients with follicular lymphoma does very, very well with first treatment. And depending on what that treatment is, that number may be substantial enough that I think it's going to be hard for us to not think that some of those patients, even with advanced stage disease, are cured. So I'll close with a little bit of a deep dive on this trial. This was a SWOG trial that was conducted by Ali Press, who died tragically of a brain cancer several years ago. But this trial goes all the way back to the year 2000. And this trial originally had a CHOP alone arm, which quickly was eliminated, but really looked at CHOP with either rituximab or iodine-131 tocilizumab, which is a radio-labeled anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. It's not really used much anymore. That's a whole different discussion. Early follow-up of this trial did not suggest much of a difference between the two arms. Longer follow-up suggested actually that the PFS was better with the radio-labeled antibody, but that benefit was abrogated by late toxicities, including myelodysplasia and leukemia. So the radio-labeled antibody is not the reason why I'm presenting this trial. I'm presenting this trial because we have very detailed follow-up, and I think this may be the longest follow-up of a clinical trial in the modern chemoimmunotherapy era, which I'm defining as when rituximab was used. So if you look at the entire cohort, because the differences weren't too much between the two arms, the overall survival at 15 years was 70%. For what it's worth, when I was training, we used to tell patients that the median overall survival of follicular lymphoma was between 6 and 8 years. So, I mean, this is, we still haven't even hit the median at 15-year follow-up. And the progression-free survival at 15 years was 40%. So that, in and of itself, is a pretty high number. Patients with high tumor burden follicular lymphoma get 6 cycles of R-CHOP, no maintenance, and 15 years later, 40% of them are alive and disease-free. Now, you look at that PFS curve, and you might say, well, I'm not seeing any plateau on that curve. It's just, slow, steady decline, and that's how we've been trained to think about follicular lymphoma. So I think you have to remember what PFS curves are showing us. So the events on a PFS curve include disease progression or death, and the death can be from any cause. So patients are walking onto this trial in their mid-60s. Many of them are maybe up to 70 years old. 15 years later, they're between 80 and 85 years old. There are a lot of deaths that are occurring that are completely unrelated to lymphoma because patients are hitting the end of their lifespan. Put another way, in any study, if you were to graph a PFS curve for 50 or 100 years, it would always go down to zero because none of us live forever. So for this disease, PFS is probably not the marker that you can use to define whether a patient is cured or not. So we tried to do a careful analysis of this, and what this is showing you are taking out the deaths from other causes, and we were very conservative at the attribution of deaths. And if you do that, you can see that on the dotted line, that's the death from other causes, and you can see, not surprisingly, as time goes on, that keeps going up, up, up. And this curve, which is the death without progression, that's the bottom curve, either death with progression or just a progression event is this curve, and you can see that this curve is starting to flatten out. And if you look by periods of time, the average progression rate per year, not taking out deaths from other causes, for the first 5 years is about 6.8%, drops to 2.3%, and then after 10 years, it's about 1%, and after 15 years, it's less than 1%. So if your practice is to just keep following patients with follicular lymphoma because at some point they're going to relapse, the patient comes into your office 15 years after their R-CHOP treatment, you can look at them and say there's a 99.5% chance you're not going to have an event in the next year that's related to your follicular lymphoma. And, you know, based on this, it's likely that the vast, vast majority of those patients are cured of follicular lymphoma, such that they will never experience an event related to follicular lymphoma. We then did a cure modeling of this. So this was then taking these data and comparing them to age-matched controls, looking as well at some comorbidities. And when you do that, you can see that when you hit about 15 years, the excess hazard rate goes essentially to zero, meaning that any excess events that are different from the baseline population disappear with that level of follow-up. And therefore, we determined using this modeling that about 47% of patients on this trial were cured with chemoimmunotherapy. Again, the reason why that 47% is higher than the PFS curve at 15 years reading out at 40% is because some of these patients are dying of other causes. Not surprisingly, if you look at clinical risk, patients who come in with low clinical risk have a higher cure rate, but even the patients who come in with high FLIPI scores or high beta 2 microglobulin, about a third of those patients are cured. So, of course, waiting 15 years is not something that we want to do in practice. We have spent about 10 years trying to define the group of patients who are the highest risk group of follicular lymphoma. There's this, you know, PFS 24 calculator. There are a number of gene expression and molecular profiles that are trying to establish who those patients are. I think it may be time to do the flip and try to define who the cured patients are going to be. And we did look at MRD assessment here using the clonoSEQ assay, and there's a mixed message here. The first message is that if you're MRD detectable, about 28% of patients were at the end of treatment and at 1 year of follow-up, those patients had a very, very low likelihood of cure. If you're MRD undetectable, that rate, you know, the PFS rate actually goes up a little bit, and probably the cure rate goes up a little bit as well. So that's good news, and we'd say, oh, this may be our answer. The problem is 36 out of 163 had no trackable clone, and an additional 11 patients didn't have enough matching to be able to do the analysis. So unlike large cell lymphoma, where you almost always are able to find a clone and move forward, that's not really the case with follicular lymphoma. So I'll just conclude in the high tumor burden follicular lymphoma situation. I think long-term follow-up studies demonstrate a subset of patients with durable event-free survival, suggesting possibility of cure. Because of this, I think chemoimmunotherapy should remain the gold standard upfront treatment until trials demonstrate with very long follow-up that something equivalent is also mediating cures. I put my current approach to follicular lymphoma here, which we can go back to. I'll just summarize it and say that I'll occasionally use obinutuzumab if there's a high-risk situation. I try to use anthracycline-based approaches in the old grade 3 situation. I know that's not an in-vogue term anymore. And I rarely use maintenance because of infection risk. These are two phase 3 studies that are going on right now in advanced stage follicular lymphoma. Both of them are asking bispecific antibody questions similar to what we're asking in the low tumor burden situation. And I think many of us in the field are confident that these bispecific antibodies are going to have a meaningful impact fairly quickly in the upfront treatment of follicular lymphoma. And I'll just conclude with a few final thoughts. therapy at relapse can be highly effective. So how important is progression-free survival? Maybe you don't need to cure patients. And, you know, if you can incrementally keep people going, that may be good enough. That said, both from a cost standpoint and a psychological standpoint, if you can efficiently cure a patient, that's, I think, always the best principle in medicine. And of course, can we define molecular subsets for rational therapeutic targeting and a precision approach to treatment? I wish I could be more optimistic in this regard. This has been a variant of the conclusion of my talk in follicular lymphoma for like 15 years. And I would say, despite a tremendous amount of work by many, many groups, we're really not further along there. We just have a few signals out there. I look forward to spending some time in your beautiful city tomorrow. Thank you again for the invitation.